Welcome to the Ness Podcast, a podcast of the weekly preaching ministry of Ness Avenue Baptist Church, where we seek to equip people to love God and love others.
I don't know if there's any more pervasive sin than pride. Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot this week, and so many sins, so many of our problems, so many of our character flaws, I think you can sort of isolate them down to pride. And so that's what we're going to take a look at today, and we're going to look at why it's so destructive, what God does about it, and the joy of humility, which is really the opposite of pride. We kicked off a series on sin last week where we looked at really the anatomy of sin, what's kind of going on at the heart of sin. And Jeremiah chapter 2 showed us that sin is really an attitude of our hearts. It's a distortion and a dislocation of our heart's true affection, which should be on God. So that was kind of like a basic definition that I sort of returned to, that it is a distortion and a dislocation of our heart's true affection, which should be on God, but we put it on something else. We fail to give our awe to God, and instead we give it to some other thing. And that was the heart of Jeremiah chapter 2, and really what the sin of the Hebrew people was. And that is the anatomy of what sin is. And I think we live in a time where our society really seems to be obsessed with sin. In a variety of ways, we really seem to be obsessed with calling out sin, calling out what others are doing as being wrong. I think never before has a culture been so public with their take on what is right and what is wrong in the world, and we hear it so loudly all the time. Pride has many faces. Calling out the wrongs of others, that can be pride. You know, when we say things like, did you hear about what so-and-so did? Because sometimes when we're doing that, in essence, we're saying, you know, I don't have that problem, but look at what that person did. Look at the problem that they have. I'm better than that personally. You know, that's kind of one form of pride, but there's more. You know, when you're jealous about what someone else has, you know, you're essentially saying they don't deserve that thing. I deserve it more than they do. That's pride. You know, when you're going through something hard and you're bitter about it, essentially you are saying that I don't deserve to suffer. That's pride. When we have, sometimes when we have a discussion in our home about a specific topic, a random topic maybe, usually I feel like I'm right. At least in my own eyes. You know, I'm right pretty much 100% of the time. I've got a pretty good batting average. I have a very difficult time ever saying it's hard. I have a hard time saying I was wrong. That's pride. Is it true? It's pretty true. I think all of us to some extent have that. I know I struggle with it. You know, there's numerous places in my life, and as I've been like kind of reading through this chapter, as I've been studying about it this week, I can see where pride has taken like a little hold of me in numerous places, and maybe not little. Maybe it's more pervasive than what I think it is. Sometimes we can think, well, pride, that's not something that I struggle with. There's maybe some sins. Pride, that's not one of them. But I think once we start looking a little bit deeper inside and we start looking at what lies behind many of the things that we're struggling with, I think we can see that potentially pride is right there amongst it. So this passage in Daniel chapter 4, let's turn our attention there because I think it really does start to give us an idea of what we're talking about here. And this passage that you read this past week and as you heard read this morning, it's a very clear look at God's view of pride. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, he was this man who had absolute power. I mean, if you could say that anybody was really the master of the universe, Nebuchadnezzar would be that guy. You know, as far as they knew what the universe was anyway, as far as the eye could see, as far as they knew of things that existed, he pretty much had control over all of it. There was maybe only like a handful of people in all of the earth's history that has ever had as much power as this guy. He's maybe up there with like maybe four or five other people in the history of our universe that had as much power and control and as much influence as Nebuchadnezzar had. He built Babylon, which was a city that was more impressive than any city you could imagine. It was a great city. Of all of the world cities that have ever happened, this city was absolutely above them all. Babylon was the largest city in the world at the time. It was close to what is present-day Baghdad in Iraq. Not very far, only a few miles away from that, where that is today. It was known for its moat that ran around the entire city, which served as a defense for the city. Now, in the midst of a desert, to have a water moat that ran around your entire city was really quite an accomplishment. This was in the desert. It, of course, had one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, which was the Hanging Gardens. Not sure exactly what that looked like, but it was known. It is known to this day as one of the wonders of the ancient world. The whole city was like this beautiful green park in the middle of this desert. This was all his. He built this all. Yet his life falls apart. He has it all. I mean, he can do whatever he wants. He has absolutely nothing to fear. There is nothing. There is no one that can come against him because he has ultimate power. He has every single means at his disposal. There is nothing that can attack him or influence him. Yet he can't sleep. He's plagued. He is plagued by this dream that he has had. He has all things. He has nothing to fear and yet nothing to worry about. Yet this dream that he has plagues him. And ultimately, he's actually glad. Because there was a spiritual cancer that was within him, and it needed to be destroyed. And what would happen to him was worth it. So this morning, think this through. Could our minds be as troubled as his was? Might our sleep be as disturbed as his was? Is God getting your attention about the pride in your life, or will he have to humble you like this? Maybe not exactly like this, maybe something like this. So let's take a look at the allure of pride, the heart of pride, the outcome of pride, and ultimately the healing of pride. Verse 29 shows, it says this, all of this takes place 12 months after something happened. That's what verse 29 says. Well, what was it? Well, 12 months earlier, he had a dream that he was deeply troubled by. And you would think that this is one guy, as we have said, who never has to worry. He has it all. Nothing can be done against him. He has no need to fear, no need to worry about any man. Nothing. He's the top of the heap, and he knows it. It was actually kind of funny. I was listening to the news this week, and one of the stories was about Donald Trump on Monday. He said he had this like much criticized attempt to stage the G7 at one of his golf courses. I think it was as an act of goodwill. He had it and said, we might as well come here and use it. It won't cost us all that much. But he kind of got lambasted because they said it was to promote his business brand. So he replied this in the newspaper I read this week. It says, they say, oh, you get a promotion. You don't think I get enough promotion? I get more promotion than any human being that has ever lived, he said. I don't need promotion. I kind of chuckled when I heard that because I was just reading these words by Nebuchadnezzar. But, you know, it's true. You really can't deny that what he said is factual. I mean, I don't know if anyone is more promoted than that guy, so it is true. But to make that kind of a statement, imagine yourself making these kind of massive statements. So we're told in verse 4 that Nebuchadnezzar, he was at ease in his house and he was prospering in his palace. He was at ease and he was prospering. Nothing could harm him. Nothing could touch him. But he had this dream that absolutely terrified him. And it was of a tree. And this tree, it reached up into the heavens. The whole earth could see it. It was a massive tree. And all of the earth fed from the fruit of this tree. And all of the earth could find shelter under its branches. But then a heavenly voice calls out that the tree should be cut down. Only the stump should remain. The mind of this tree would change from a man's to a beast's, and it will remain this way for seven periods of time, which is a time that was set forth by this heavenly being. This will happen so that the earth will know that the Most High rules the kingdom. He gives it to whoever he wills, even the lowliest of men. So Nebuchadnezzar, he calls Daniel in to interpret this dream. And when Daniel hears this dream, he instantly goes white. The blood just runs out of his face. He was dismayed and he was alarmed. Imagine having to give this message to the most powerful man on earth, and he says, "You, O king, are that tree." Well, 12 months pass, and it happens. He loses his mind, and he lives among the beasts of the field. His kingdom is taken away. His hair grows long, and his fingernails become like a bird's claws. What do we see in this? You see this person here, no matter how content and how prosperous you may be, it's never complete. There still could be something missing. You see, you're always left vulnerable, you're always left wanting. But yet this is I think sometimes a compulsion that we have. We think, if I only had this much power, if I only had this much money, if I only had this whatever thing that it might be, then I would be able to stand on my own two feet, be proud in what I have accomplished, and not to have to worry about anything. But you could have no more than Nebuchadnezzar ever had, and it wasn't enough to keep him peaceful. There was still this peace that was missing, and his pride was ruling and raging within his heart. He couldn't sleep, and for 12 months after the dream, it got even worse. Yet the pride just continued to rage. You see, filling that hole with more in your life will never happen. It will never bring that ultimate completion. It's a cavernous well that no power can ever satisfy. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar is beginning to realize, or he will very quickly. So 12 months after this dream, Nebuchadnezzar gets up and he says in verse 30, "Is this not the great Babylon which I have built my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" So that would be pride. Pretty easy to spot. You see, pride looks at all the good things in your life and says, "That's me. I did it. I deserve this. I am owed these good things," and it feels so good to revel in them. When life is well, it's because you have done it. And then when life goes badly, you say, "I am suffering more than other people. People probably don't understand what I am going through because my suffering is worse." And that's the same thing. Those are two sides of the same coin. Pride claims to be the author of what is really a gift. Pride claims to be an offer of what is really a gift. Humility looks like, it looks at life and says, "You know, all of this is a gift. If I got what I deserved, I would be destroyed." Humility receives all of these things as a gift. Because it all comes down to this: what does the Bible say? Who is the author of life? Who does the Bible say is the author of life? You know, if I would be like, it'd be kind of like if Tanya wrote me a beautiful poem. And this poem was so beautiful. It's a love poem, obviously. It's about me. And I took that poem and I brought it to Hallmark and I said, "Here is this beautiful poem that I have written that I will sell to you so that you can use it in greeting cards." And I sell it to them and they put my picture on the back of the card as the author, and now everyone can see that I'm a great poet. Well, no. You know, that person, in this case, Tanya, gets to decide what happens to that poem. She is the author. She gets the credit. The fact that it's about me does not give me the authority over it. It doesn't make me become the author of that poem. You see, pride is that which claims to be the author of that which is really a gift. Pride is that which claims to be the author of that which is really a gift. So yes, I mean, you work and you get rewarded. You work hard, you get rewarded. But you didn't choose a lot of things. You know, you didn't choose your nationality. You didn't choose where you were born. You didn't choose your gender. You didn't choose which century you were born in. You have no say whether you were born in the 21st century or 14th century Europe during the bubonic plague. You didn't think that that has had a little bit of an impact into who you are today? You say, "Well, I've worked hard for what I have." But with what? With the mind and the means and the experiences that you have had. You had no control whether you were born with an IQ of 140 or 50. You had zero control over that, yet you don't think that it had something to do with how you have turned out. You didn't choose your parents. You didn't choose your siblings or the friends that you grew up with. You didn't choose the early childhood experiences which have shaped you. I think we can see the point here. I could be given every hockey lesson and opportunity that Mark Scheifele has, yet do you think that that would make me as good as he is? No, it wouldn't. Every opportunity, all the exact same ones, wouldn't matter. So how can we still feel prideful over those things that we have accomplished? You know, I so often say, and I sometimes hear other people say, you know, every breath that I take is a gift of God. And that is true. That's only the tip of the iceberg. It's not just that breath that is the gift of God, but it's all that you have, it's all that you enjoy, every gift that you have. These are all gifts that He has given us. You know, I think what this does is it calls us to work hard. It doesn't say, well, if all of it is just a gift, then I'll just use it, and I'll just take it all in, and I'll just sit back. But this really calls us to work hard with all of the good gifts that God has given us. How are we going to leverage those good things? Don't waste any of them. Use them all for the benefit that God has given them to you for His glory. So we work hard, and we take all of those good things that God has given us, and we make the most out of every opportunity that He lays before us, every opportunity that our gifts afford us to be able to do. How does the Bible speak to this? Because pride is so pervasive, not just here in the Old Testament, all the way through the Bible, it keeps coming up again and again. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6 to 7, Paul is speaking to the Corinthians who think they're pretty big stuff. The Corinthians are very proud in who they are and what they have accomplished as well. And Paul says this, 1 Corinthians 4, 6 and 7. Dear brothers and sisters, I have used Apollos and myself to illustrate what I've been saying. If you pay attention to what I have quoted from the scriptures, you won't be proud of one of your leaders at the expense of another. For what gives you the right to make such a judgment? What do you have that God hasn't given to you? And if everything that you have is from God, then why boast as though it were not a gift? Why would you boast in anything that you have as not being a gift from God? The heart of pride was there, and it was deep amongst them. Because there's an outcome to all of this. We see it in verse 31 and verse 32. It says this: while the words were still on the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and He gives it to whom He will. So Nebuchadnezzar went insane, and he lived like an animal for a very long time. Did he do this to himself? Did the most powerful man who maybe has ever lived have any control over this? No, it was a lesson. You see, God said to him in essence, because you have aspired to become more than a man, you will become less than a man. And the outcome is a little bit like what Krista posted for me on our social media accounts this past week, which was a quote from C.S. Lewis in his book, Mere Christianity, that says it's got a chapter in this book on pride, this pervasive sin of pride he devotes a whole chapter to. And he said, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only having more of it than the next guy. You see, it's always a comparison. What do I have compared to what someone else has? If I have more, I'm doing good, and it's because I've built it and I've done it. If I don't have as much, I become jealous because I deserve it more than they do. It's always comparison. It's always competitive. Pride gets no pleasure out of just merely having something, only having more of it than somebody else does. And that's what pride begins to do in our hearts. See, the outcome of pride is that it starts eating away at your heart. It starts eating away at your loves. It starts eating away at your very core until you suddenly become a completely different person than you were. The outcome of pride is that it begins to have these effects within you, but it doesn't end there because there is a healing. There is a healing of pride. See, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't dealing with his pride, so God did it for him. And it was a gift. Even what he went through was actually a gift, and he becomes actually happy about the fact that he went through it, I guess you could say. He was glad that he went through it. He saw that it was necessary what he went through. The only way for pride to be healed is by God doing it. I don't know if you remember that scene. I'm sure you do. If you've ever read through The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis. And it's called, this one scene called The Undragoning of Eustace. It's one of the most famous scenes in the book. And it's definitely one of the best. And Eustace, he's this, I think it's like a perfect sort of illustration of what's happening here. It's like a bit of a parallel. And I'm sure C.S. Lewis had this story in mind when he wrote this. Because Eustace is this character you just kind of want to punch in the face. Because he's so annoying. Until he has this transformational experience with Aslan. He was arrogant. He was self-centered. And he was just this all-around annoying guy to Edmund and Lucy and everybody else. His pride was just off the charts. Well, Eustace, this guy, he gets turned into a dragon at one point. And being turned into a dragon is really a personification of who he has become. And who he already had become in his heart becomes on his exterior. And he wants to change. He becomes this dragon, but he doesn't like being a dragon, and he wants to change back into being a boy. And so he starts to try to peel the dragon skin off, and layer by layer he begins to peel it off, but it's not helping. He's still a dragon. So eventually Aslan, who is the Christ-like figure in the story, he comes to him, and this is what it says. That night, Aslan came to Eustace and leads him to a large well, like a very big round bath with marble steps going down into it. Eustace describes the scene to Edmund after the fact. He says that the water was so clear, and he thought if he could just get in there and bathe, it would ease the pain in his leg. There was a bracelet attached to his leg that had become very discomforting when he becomes this dragon. But Aslan told him he had to undress first. And God, doesn't God ask this of all of us? Eustace found that no matter how many layers of this dragon skin he managed to peel off himself, he was still a dragon. Then the lion said, "But I don't know if he spoke. You will have to let me undress you." Well, I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just lay flat down on my back, and I let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it was going right into my heart. And then he began pulling the skin off. It hurt worse than anything that I have ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked the scab off of a sore place, it hurts like a billy-o, but it's such fun to see it coming away. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, and there was I, as smooth and as soft as a peeled switch, and smaller than I had been. Then he caught a hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath now that I had had no skin on. And he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment, and after that it became perfectly delicious. And as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all of the pain had gone. And then I saw why I had turned into a boy again. The only way this happens is when God does it. And God gets our attention and we start to become aware of it. And this happens, you know, he didn't like the fact that he had turned into this dragon. Nebuchadnezzar knew what he had become and he was waiting. He couldn't turn himself back into a man. God had to do this work. And maybe God is doing that work in our lives. Maybe there's things that we're seeing that is God getting our attention in. There's things that are disconnects, dislocations of our heart that we're finding. Is this a work that God is doing? Is there something here that I'm holding on to that I need to surrender to him, that I need to allow him to begin to heal in my life? The only way to heal your pride is to see two things together. Number one is that you don't deserve anything from God but judgment. And number two is that you have to see that all you have is because of the rich mercy of God. And we have to see both of those. What is it that we truly deserve? And what is it that God has given us out of his richness of his mercy? And we got to see both of those things. And Nebuchadnezzar was able to see both in his speech at the end when he says this in verse 34. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven. And my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" And at the very same time, my reason returned to me, And for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and my splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords, they sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and I extol and I honor the King of heaven, for all of his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. This is what God is able to do, and this is the lesson, this is the understanding that Nebuchadnezzar came to see. You see, he thought he was the master of the universe and he took it all for himself. But Jesus is the only one who has ever lived who truly was the master of the universe, and he gave it all away. He didn't take it all for himself, but he gives it all away. What God tells Isaiah of his coming Messiah, he says this about him. In Isaiah chapter 52, "See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised. He will be lifted up. He will be highly exalted, more highly than anyone else who has ever lived. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form was marred beyond human likeness." He too was transformed into something. And he did that for us. Jesus was high. He was lifted up. He was the true ruler of all, but he gave it all up. He was beaten. He was disfigured, more so than any human being has ever been. Even beyond human likeness, it says, he went to this extent. And then he was lifted up again, but this time it was lifted up to the cross, bearing the weight of sin and shame that was rightfully yours, all in this act of true humility, of true service, of true healing, the ultimate act of humbling. The Lord Jesus humbled himself so that you could be forgiven, so that you also would humble yourself and accept the mercy that God is offering to you. How can we remain prideful when we serve the ultimate servant king?
Thank you for tuning into the Ness Podcast. And be sure to check us out online at www.nessbaptist.com for all our past sermons. Ness Avenue Baptist Church, where we seek to equip people to love God and love others.